Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey folks, welcome to From the Vault, episode number 7, and hot on the heels of our triple bill of Bright Eyes with Kyle Wood from Lovers Turn to Monsters, we thought what we would do is take a trip back in time to episode 140 when we covered our up until recently only emo band from Saddle Creek Records, Cursive, and their record The Ugly Organ. I really like this record, I picked it, spoiler alert, but this is a really good little jumping off point because we talk a little bit about Bright Eyes and Deaths of Parasidos in this episode, although we profess to not know much about them, which was true at the time. It's not true anymore though. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this episode. It's a fun one. Dave back. We got him at the jail. Well done, woo! Folks. Well done. Well done.
That used up all our reserves, though. Yeah. To get him on parole.
And a huge amount of bail.
Yeah. All the 40 quid that we didn't have, we no longer have anymore. So please top up our funds, our coffers.
What do you think you'd have to do in Scotland for your bail to be set at 40 quid?
Is that low or high? Never been in jail.
Dave knows. What do you have to do in Inverness for your bail to be 40 quid, Dave? Quick, quick, quick.
Oh, rename a sheep. Yeah, without proper registry.
Please go to patreon.com/unsungpod where we will add a new category called rename a sheep for $40. So basically, I don't know if you guys have realised this, but the world is now fucked. It's been refucked. We thought it was maybe unfucked, but it's now refucked. Things are just going to get harder for a lot of us, so anything you can give us to make running this podcast a little bit easier. We don't want to make money from it, we just want to break even. And, you know, we're pretty close to that. So if you could help us out, that would be super appreciated.
Yeah, it turns out we're not very good at the money part of it, just judging by how bad we are at turning listeners into funds. So yeah. Help us out.
So don't skip this part, you cunt.
Yeah, maybe calling people cunts is the way forward.
But yeah,
it's kind of edgy humour they're here for, Dave.
Go to the aforementioned URL, you can see lots of very cool things we'll give you, including a brand new Access All Areas Facebook group, which has got banter-ish stuff on it, I don't know.
All kinds of sheep names.
All kinds
place.
Of sheep names. Yeah, so hit us up on Patreon and join our Facebook group and give us your favourite sheep name. Bye.
That time of the week.
Ding, ding. It's the Unsung Podcast, yeah! Hey, folks.
We do need a theme tune. Remember all those fucking years ago now, where Fritz had made that amazing Nexus theme song.
Yeah, we need something bespoke.
Yeah, we do. I mean, the one that's in there was really just a placeholder that I made up. Although, Mark, did you notice that it had the Nexus from WWE in it?
Yeah.
And I didn't mention that in the wrestling episode. Yeah. We do need some more bespoke music. I'm happy with the title track. That's great, the Marvin song, but that Nexus needs some.
Yeah, I mean, no Fritz, you're still listening, so if you want to think about something else, we would really appreciate that.
Hey, come on, Fritz, when was the last time you gave us £100 and a custom written song?
Well, how are you guys this week?
You're both very quiet. It's nice to be back.
Dave stumbled out the bush about 5 days ago.
Yeah, I'm back from walkabout. I can't believe that you did a fucking wrestling podcast. Not that you did it without me, I just can't believe you did it.
It's the kindest thing we've ever done to you, was doing that when you weren't here.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm glad that I didn't have to be involved, that's for sure, but great work.
I mean, don't take it personally, but it was slightly more fun than average.
It's gone down a fucking treat as well.
Who was it, the Road Warrior that
Road
died?
Road Warrior or? Animal. 66 years old. R.I.P.
Hey, that is pretty old for a wrestler.
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently when Chris Benoit died, we all know that didn't go very well. He had the brain of an 84-year-old man.
Well, I mean, jeez. How old was he?
Was he like late 30s, Mark?
In his 30s.
Yeah. 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that from getting bashed about? Is that from the steroids? Is that from being a maniac? Bit of all three?
Yeah. Probably all of
all
those.
Three, yeah. All three of those things.
Unfortunately, it was his family that paid the price, more so than him.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. There you go, Dave. That's one good reason to keep kids off wrestling. So,
well, I mean, it's lethal.
You can use that against us.
Yeah, but we'd dangerous.
Like most bad habits, we had a fine time doing it last week.
I'm trying to think of what we could do. If you two are away, what would my podcast be about?
What would it be about, Dave?
I don't know. Like, we've already done new metal, so I'm really thinking about getting into model railways, but
Rod Stewart's really into model railways. You ever seen
Is he?
That?
Nah.
Rod Stewart has the most incredible model railways. However, it caused a lot of problems because somebody did a big article about it and they reported him as English pop musician Rod Stewart. And the thing is, technically Rod Stewart is English. He was the only member of his family born in London.
Yeah.
But I think he very much identifies as a Scotsman.
Yeah.
So it was problematic. But yeah, he bloody loves a good railway, that lad.
Well, I recently seen somebody post on Twitter the classic clip of Rod Stewart calling the Scottish Football Cup teams, pulling them out the hat.
Oh, yeah, doing the draw. It's absolutely fantastic.
So good.
And he's steaming. Just,
I told you before the day that he did that, that he was, there was a game on at Airdrie Stadium just before he did that draw, and he was spotted in Airdrie in one of those windowless old man's pubs, you know, the kind that you get in Scotland where they look like bomb shelters.
Yeah.
And he was in this old man's pub when my friends walked in singing Rod Stewart on karaoke.
So, amazing.
Anyway, Mark, this is your choice of music this week. Obviously, it was another one, a bit like Burial, that got postponed, but we got round to it.
Mm-hmm. It's not Rod Stewart, unfortunately. It's The Ugly Organ by the Omaha, Nebraskan band Cursive.
Yeah, like, this is a funny one, because when you mentioned Cursive, I was like, oh yeah, Cursive. I didn't know all about them, and then I realised that I didn't know fucking anything about them.
Who did you think it was?
I don't know, I get it mixed up with somebody else, but I also just...
Is it Rod Stewart?
Yeah, I mean, I have seen Cursive do Rod Stewart karaoke in a Coat Bridge, so easily
Small
mixed
world.
Up.
Small
I don't know, they
world.
Were just always a band from when I was about 18 to 25 that I knew existed. And I think I lived with an emo and he was obsessed with him. And I always remember this album art when I looked at it, but I don't think I've ever listened to them. So I was very surprised by what I heard.
I used to gang about with a couple of emos when I was younger. I don't think I was massively emo myself. I liked a few of them. Obviously, I liked Far and stuff like that, the older school stuff. But I ended up going to see Cursive at King Tut's in Glasgow, and I think it was actually quite a sought-after ticket, and I was one of those annoying people at a gig that doesn't really care or appreciate what they've got, but I was taken along, and it was fine. It was fine. I remember there being a lot of brass, so it must have been
Happy Hollow,
the album after this, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was at that show as well.
See, I don't particularly like brass in the context of punk, because ska is just devil's piss in my ears. And so I wasn't sure what to make of it, but the heavier, chunkier bits, which I'm sure we'll talk about, I was like, oh, this is okay. But it was just okay. I wasn't blown away by it, and I never went back and listened to them much recreationally. What I have noticed, though, in the course of listening to not just this album but the other albums to try and get a bit of context, is that Cursive are really sort of like a very useful reference point for loads of the biggest names of the sort of late 90s, early 2000s emo post-hardcore scene, especially in the American Midwest. So there's going to be a lot of names popping up. And that, for me at least, is probably going to be the bulk of what I can bring to this conversation.
Well, I mean, I was very excited to see that one of them was in Smash Mouth, but it turned out it was not a different Smash Mouth.
Different,
so
yeah, exactly.
I was really let down by that.
I was looking at that, I was like, that's such a tiny Wikipedia entry for Smash Mouth. And then you realise why. Disambiguation. This is not the Smash Mouth that played at Donald Trump's rally.
It is not. It is not. So, yeah, I guess we should probably do a wee bit of history about the band Cursive. As Chris says, they're part of that sort of Midwestern emo scene. They were formed in 1995, which is fucking hell, man, they've been around for so long. This album we're going to talk about was our fourth album, that's how I got into them, but obviously before that they'd released a bunch of records and EPs. Sort of frontman, but kind of the brains behind the whole band really is a guy called Tim Casher, and he formed Cursive after his old band Slow Down Virginia broke up. It's so the main core of the lineup has been ostensibly Tim Casher, Matt Magan, and Steve Pedersen on guitar, and also Clint Schnasse. Is that how you say his name?
Schnasse,
yeah, on drums, who's recently came back to the band as well. He left not long after Happy Hollow.
It was interesting, like, looking at their heritage. I mean, it's going to be really obvious that they came from Omaha, Nebraska, which is also where Conor Oberst and therefore Bright Eyes, Desaparecidos and those kind of bands come from. And I think it can't be a coincidence that they have some very similar qualities to their sound. And even just their themes, their approach. But that part of America was quite interesting at the time. You had, these guys were about 95 they got together?
Yeah.
I think At The Drive-In had got together in Texas in 94. They got a lot of early comparisons to them. Bands like Shudder to Think. Jawbreaker from New York,
yep.
And I think a lot of those comparisons are fair. There's probably a couple others, like I think there's a fair bit of Husker Du and Sugar, bits of Fugazi and bands like Archers of Loaf. But in the Midwest kind of states, or at least the sort of off the beaten track kind of states, you had the likes of Appleseed Cast. Formed in Kansas in 97. There's a lot of those in here. In Illinois, now I know Illinois is Chicago, but it's also a lot of other places as well. In Illinois, you had the likes of Captain Jazz from like 89, followed by Joan of Arc. Fly, You also had Braid, who I think have quite a lot to say in the music of Cursive. You got Juno 44 from Kentucky in 94. You had the band called Branston from Ohio in 96. You had the Promise Ring from Wisconsin in 95. Then you had a load of other bands that were appearing in the Washington scene, like Smart Went Crazy and Blue Tip and bands like that. But he was only daydreaming about the future without his wife. So it was quite a sort of fecund period for that style, like post-hardcore. There obviously was a parallel movement that from far went much more in the direction of sort of pop-punk, emo, more commercial, waily, haircut, slick, that kind of thing. This band sit, I think, at the crossroads of those two different paths. On the album you've chosen, I feel they do get about as close as they were going to get to some of the more mainstream stuff. Yet they never really lose the alternative sound that probably kept them on a certain level.
Yeah, so a lot of their history is like, apart from all the bands you mentioned, they were also tied up in, as you kind of hinted at, like the whole kind of Bright Eyes thing. So Saddle Creek Records, they didn't come onto Saddle Creek Records until their second album, The Storms of Early Summer. Their first album, Such Blinding Stars for Starving Eyes, was released on Crack Records.
For people that are in my sort of position as well, just to kind of help them out, because I had to look it up. Saddle Creek, if you recognise the name. They've also had, obviously, Desaparecidos, the Burst band that we mentioned, but Hop Along, Azure Ray, Hand Habits, The Good Life, which is Casher's other project. I would say it's quite a well-known label, but certainly in certain circles, it's a fairly familiar name.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to get onto. So Saddle Creek predates this band. I don't know why it took them so long to get onto that label, but they were definitely all in or around, you know, that scene. Mike Mogus, the guy who kind of started Saddle Creek with Conor O'Bear's brother, Justin, he was one of the producers on their first album. So clearly being in Omaha, being a part of this particularly large scene for Midwestern emo, obviously did them quite a lot of favours. Some of the bands Chris mentioned there are kind of the more notable ones that have come out, you know, from that record label, from that part of the world. For some reason, Omaha seems to still be quite a musical hub for the Midwest, even if it isn't necessarily something you would associate with music if you're not entrenched in this kind of alternative or kind of post-hardcore thing that some of us are.
The Midwest is one of those regions that, a bit like parts of Europe, there aren't so many parts of it where you really feel that if you break through, you can go there and get success. You know, it's a bit like London in the UK. That used to be that old trope. But certainly New York, LA, even, you know, parts of Texas or Chicago, I suppose, is probably their closest point. But you imagine there's just loads and loads of bands that pop into existence and then drop out of existence and never quite get a look in because it's such a vast terrain.
Well, I mean, it's literally, yeah, it's so far from anywhere else. You know, it's miles and miles and miles of cornfields and wheat fields and stuff like that. So for a young band, if you grow up in LA, then you can go and play 20 venues within a month, within 100 miles, and never play at the same person. Whereas in Nebraska, you can travel 100 miles and not see a venue.
Yeah, I think it's, it always kind of pops into my head when I think about it, even just analogously Scotland. There's parts of Scotland where, you know, there was bands appeared that could have done something, maybe had one or two very good songs and then just vanished again, and multiply that by 100 for these huge expansive parts of the USA and for other countries as well, where these bands never really quite play to the right audiences or get a chance to attain that momentum. It's quite staggering to think about how many truly amazing tunes, even forget albums, but just amazing songs that probably never really got heard.
And that kind of speaks to this whole idea of how those bands are often said to have the Omaha sound, which is a huge thing, right? Cursive being an instrumental part in that, Saddle Creek being a key driver in it, and from an indie point of view as well, you know. And yeah, it is interesting how these kind of parts of the world can, how the kind of the dereliction around it brings people together into the one place. You know, Cursive kind of come from such rich stock in that regard, you know, that they're all openly admitted they're middle class boys who kind of grew up in Catholic households, just kind of very much from this little part of the world, and a lot of people who they knew had similar interests in music as they did, and it kind of led to this expansive sort of clutch of bands. And the Ugly Organ is seen as being a part of this scene, which we'll get to in a wee sec.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of do their prehistory, was it 96 their first record came out, which, by the way, has that archetypal style of your first EP in a band. It's called Disruption.
Yeah.
The Disruption EP. Just Dave, I'm pretty sure your high school band probably had a record called the Disruption EP.
Yeah, most likely.
97, they'd Sucker and Dry EP. Then their debut album in 97 was Such Blinding Stars for Starving Eyes. Followed by the Icebreaker EP in 98. And then, I mean, we'll talk about the early records, but just in 98, the band basically split. Tim Casher got married and moved to Portland, Oregon, and Steve Pedersen, one of the founder members and one of the guys from Slowdown Virginia, decided to go to law school. Luckily, Tim Casher's marriage was a disaster. He got divorced a year later, moved back, and they resumed the band, at which point Pedersen was replaced by Ted Stevens, who then went on to be in the band indefinitely. Just before they broke up, I know they released what they thought was going to be their swan song. It's called The Storms of Early Summer, colon, Semantics of Song. Mm-hmm. Some proper late 90s emo titling. Yep. Just on those records, did you spend much time with them? Because to me, immediately, they sound like the kind of thing I would have heard at the 13th Note, in the 13th Note's heyday, when it had all these sort of Midwest... Any of the bands for the States that got over here almost always played at the 13th Note in Glasgow. It was that kind of sound. That's where I saw Appleseed Cast, in fact, first time.
I hadn't really spent any time with these two records because I kind of got into them with Ugly Organ, and my knowledge of them I kind of fell out of them quite quickly when 2009's My Mama Swollen came out, but we'll come to that. So it was quite good to get acquainted with these two albums. They definitely have a kind of Fugazi, Archers of Loaf sort of vibe to them, you know, which is quite stark given that the Ugly Organ sounds, I wouldn't say vastly different, but an approach sonically, even songwriting wise, there's a huge difference. There's a gulf, in fact, I would say.
And just in terms, I think the Cursive and At the Drive-In sound very similar.
Yeah.
Mid-90s, like those first couple of like demos and records, and the vocals are kind of an afterthought to the energy, and then the vocals become much more important for both bands, and like they go down different routes, but it's interesting hearing how similar they are, you know, in those first couple of recordings.
I think that's really true. Yeah, I'd made a note as well that especially in the first one, Such Blinding Stars, I really feel the At the Drive-In comparisons are fair on that one. It's that very angsty, earnest, emo sound. Musically, it's quite basic. It does a lot of like loud, quiet shifts.
Yeah.
There's a couple of like very subtle, diminished moments in things like the track Ceilings Crack. And that's where I think you start to hear the very earliest sort of peaks of some of the more dissonant stuff they'll do later on. But other than that, it's quite straight down the line emo of that era. And the Storm of Early Summer, I can't remember. I think you can actually hear quite a lot of the sound that went on to become synonymous with Desaparecidos. I think there's a track called The Rhyme Scheme. In fact, it's the first track.
It has
quite a bit of that in that. Mm-hmm. And again, fairly typical of that late 90s emo sound. You heard a lot of these kind of bands on things like J-Tree and Deep Elm, those sort of like cult post-hardcore, indie-hardcore record labels. I mean, it's acceptable stuff. It's not bad. But they were certainly a band that was going to, as Dave says, get a much stronger sense of identity and maybe go in a much more sophisticated direction all round. I agree on the vocals, but also just musically, they decided to spend much more time focusing on what exactly they wanted to achieve with these different parts. And they definitely carved out a very distinct niche for them.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sales.
And then after that, they moved on to 2002 with Curse of Domestica, which is the actual title of the album.
And so it's begun. This is year one, the birth of a child in the form of a man.
Can we just say that this is emo and emo guys rearing their ugly heads in a big way, right? Because they released the album Domestica, which is a bunny ears inverted commas concept album about the dissolution of a marriage.
I wonder where that came from.
Exactly. The year after his disastrous marriage fell apart. I think like it just underlines how fucking self-serving emo is and how emo guys can just be such a nightmare. I think one thing about it that kind of sat badly with me as well is that on this concept album, one of the themes is infidelity of the woman, and that wasn't actually part of their marriage. That wasn't an issue. And whilst I know he's saying that it's not directly about their marriage, you know, people put two and two together, and it's sort of a little bit clumsy just after your marriage broke up to start singing about your ex-wife having been unfaithful. It's like, come on, man, think about it. Like, so self-indulgent to the detriment of the other person. I mean, it's kind of lame.
One of his best pals is no doubt, or not, I'm not going to say definitely his best pal, but one of his friends is no doubt Conor O'Bearst, who's, you know, the king of this kind of shit.
Yes.
But, you know, this album was held in really high regard by fans.
Really well reviewed when it came out as well.
Yeah. To be honest, for me, it never quite hits the mark. I can see where they're going. I can see the evolution in their songwriting. There are some good songs on it. The Martyr is a really good song. I also quite like I Read So Deep. And The Lament of Pretty Baby, I think are both pretty good songs. And you
can I throw a couple of references in as well, man?
Sure, man.
I think the first track, The Casualty, is so reminiscent of Quicksand, Walter Schreifel's band. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think not just in the kind of way that they start to get a bit chunkier, you know, they get a bit more staccato in their playing, but also just in the choice of like broken down chords that they go into, and also the third track in that, Shallow Means Deep Ends, it has a bit of the Quicksand, but it also really reminds me of the band Blue Tip that I mentioned earlier. With that sort of like cheekiness to it, the way the vocals are delivered in it, it's just generally just a bit angrier, and that staccato theme is something that I think they picked up from other bands of that time and just slightly before. I think they've been inspired, shall we say, by that approach.
So the following year they released an EP called Burst and Balloon. Which is when Greta Cohn, cello player, who had been playing with him for a number of years at this point live, but hadn't actually recorded with him, then came into the fold kind of properly as a contributor and as a player on the records. And this is when you can see the moves towards the sound of the ugly organ. I think this is a really good EP. I quite like this. Sync to the Beat is probably the highlight for that. The cello's quite stark in it. It's a totally new vibe. You can imagine fans of the band being like, what the fuck is this? What's going on here? Mm-hmm. You know?
The cello addition definitely expands their palette significantly.
Absolutely.
In fact, it puts them, just even conceptually, into a whole new area of that scene. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going from being just guitar, bass, drums. I will say, one of the bands that I think they have a bit in common with sonically, Smart Went Crazy, also used the cello. Is it in 2002... During the tour, Kesher had a collapsed lung, didn't he?
Yeah.
And the whole tour got cancelled. That's part of why they were able to spend so much time working and writing on the ugly organ, because of that collapsed lung. Is he a really thin guy? Because, I mean, in my experience, like, collapsed lungs are really associated with people that are very, very underweight.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure, to be honest.
So, obviously, Ugly Organ, you're going to talk about at length, so we'll just bounce right past that.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, without giving too much away, that they announced a pretty, well, an indefinite, but certainly a lengthy hiatus right off the back of what was by far their most commercially successful and critically successful moment, I think. That, at that point, though, Kesher refocused on that other band, he's in The Good
Life. Yeah. And they released an album called Album of the Year, which is really good.
She was convinced I was under the influence of all those drunken romantics. I was reading Fonte at the time.
Yeah, 2004, that was a critical success as well, so he wanted to devote some proper time to that. And at that point as well, did Clint Schnassa and Matt McGinn not start touring with Bright Eyes?
Yeah, and then Greta Cohn moved back to New York, and she's actually, in recent times, she's actually been involved in podcasting, podcast producer and stuff like that, which is pretty cool. The story about how she came into the band is actually really interesting. I don't know if you know it, but she obviously lived in New York, and she got a phone call. Or like, our parents got a phone call from Tess Stevens, and they were like, some cowboys trying to talk to you on the phone. We don't know what it's all about. Maybe you should call them back. And the guy was saying, do you want to come and play with us? And she was like, I just quit the band I was in, and I wanted an adventure. So I just fucked off with Cursor for 5 years and had a great time. So it was pretty cool.
They released a compilation album in 2005, The Difference Between Houses and Homes.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2006, that hiatus was, I guess, officially over when Happy Hollow came out.
Dorothy, I know you've had amazing dreams. We can't go chasing down each golden street, each and every rainbow, each passion, each unattainable goal. We're not in dreamland anymore.
I mean, they replaced the cello at this point with a five-piece horn section, and there's a bit of electronics in there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And this is the album that I almost picked, funnily enough.
I remember you mentioning it, yeah.
Because this is I heard Ugly Organ, and then they went in the hiatus, and then suddenly it was not a very long hiatus, because it was only 3 years between albums when this came out, and this is when I seen them live as well. I actually found myself being quite enamoured with this record. I think it's got a lot of really strong songs on it.
The production's a lot bigger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's very polished.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's almost... I was trying to think of a way to describe it. That production married with that kind of proggy pop punk thing that they do in it, I think it sounds like sort of like Wheatus meets Sparks or something like that. It's, I mean, it's still quite adventurous, but because it's so slickly produced, there's something a little bit too shiny about it for me. I couldn't quite get past that.
I know that there's like an irony in it, both with the artwork and production values, because the whole thing is a concept album of like a upper class God-fearing town, but it's got that sort of David Lynch, you know, there is poison beneath the surface. So I appreciate it, but it didn't grab me at all, because I liked the sort of grittier production.
Yeah, I felt like it, cerebrally I was like, oh, this is actually a very strong start, especially, but I couldn't get any real emotional connection to the record itself. There were a couple of bits. I mean, track 4 in it, Bad Sects.
Made every football game, never missed a social. Last week a boy, I taught theology. Came back in town with a new ideology. Those feelings I tucked away.
Mm-hmm. Good name. Has actually some weird Beck vibes in the delivery, mm-hmm. albeit a bit more guitar-y. And I really liked the beginning of an appearance of a little Les Savvy Fav sounds. I'm a big Les Savvy Fav fan, and I think that approach works well with them, albeit it is quite clearly a Liz Savvy Fav approach.
I quite enjoyed how it was big and bombastic, after Ugly Organ is the complete opposite thing to do, and also probably not what anybody would have expected them to do, replacing the cello and the organ with a horn section. Pretty ballsy move, especially after they just had, by in relative terms, particularly when you think about Saddle Creek being an indie record label, what could probably be considered a smash hit. You know, because Ugly Organ sold 170,000 copies, which was massive for that label, and probably still one of the biggest things they'd sold outside of Bright Eyes. And Dorothy at 40 was the song that I first heard. I think it was the first single, maybe. I can't remember. But that hooked me for that record. Tess Stevens sings in a few songs as well. Big Bang, it's pretty cool. And Bad Science as well, where his voice is totally different from Tim's, which I also quite liked. But I can totally understand why you guys would find it hard to connect with it, because it does feel very pristine.
Like, yeah, I mean, emo, pop punk, all that kind of like wider sphere, some people just cannot click with the choices that those bands make musically, and I've just always found it very hard to find a song really catchy without certain dynamics in the songwriting, and it's just not something that these bands tend to go into, and Cursive are one of those bands for me. 2009, the worst named album that we've covered in a long time.
Yep.
Mama, I'm Swollen.
Hard album to like as well, man.
Mama, it's like a Frank Zappa album. Yeah, this was the first time they appeared in David Letterman. They were, their longevity was starting to get them a lot of kudos as well. You know, they weren't just a flash in the pan, clearly. A couple of tracks in that, with again, In the Now, that first one has a lot of Liz Savvy Fav feels in it. From the Hips, it's only the second one as well, feels much more confident. I think the whole approach of the band at this point just feels more confident. There's a falsetto vocal in it that again has a bits of Tim from Liz Savvy Fav. I'm at my best when I'm trying to look and think of talking, singing, reading, write like all the rest. We're all just trying to play our roles in a play that runs ad nauseum. And I think that's almost a tune that I could have imagined on something like Root for Ruin. I think it's one of their better moments from this era.
Yeah, this album for me is quite hard to like. Maybe there's a reason these guys kept going on hiatuses, because I feel as though maybe Tim was too focused on other things at this point. I don't think the songwriting's as good as it has been. Mama, I'm Satan's okay, and What Have I Done? 6 minutes long that song is, it's pretty good too. Yeah, then the world that passed me by. I was telling everyone back home that I was taking it by storm. But for me, it just kind of washed over me. And then at this point, I was like, I'm done with this band. I'm out. So I stopped, I stopped listening to them after this.
You do start getting the diminishing returns thing, don't
they,
you?
Clint left the band, hadn't he?
Yeah.
So this is their first without Clint. And I mean, you can kind of tell that they're not doing as interesting stuff.
They released I Am Gemini in 2012, bit chunkier, but also a bit generic. There's a track
yeah,
on
it. Yeah, I thought it sounded like Senses Fail. I was like, oh, no.
there's a tune in that called Warmer Warmer that reminds me of an emo version of They Might Be Giants, and I couldn't get behind that. You're gonna wish you didn't.
There's a couple of some decent songs on it. The Sun and the Moon is pretty cool. Drunken Bird is alright as well. But nah, nothing to write home about. Not at all, really.
I take it they mean bird as in a bird, because Drunken Bird over here has a completely different connotation.
Yes. I imagine so.
Vitriola in 2018. That fucking first track name, Free to Be or Not to Be You and Me. I didn't think this was the worst, man. I mean, good, kind of dark, interesting, proggy post-hardcore. Mm-hmm. There's bits of alt-rock, there's some decent bits of electronics and atmospherics in it.
It feels like it's picked up the energy a little bit that they were missing the last couple of records.
Well, it's interesting because Clint came back for this one, and I think there is a little sense of them being a wee bit reinvigorated. It's closer to the kind of alt-indie and not that earnest post-hardcore of the late 90s at all anymore, really. I can't hear much of that.
Yeah, and then, I mean, cello and organ and keys in it, and like everything, all of it's on this. Everything they've done at this point is touched upon in this record, which is pretty clever, I think.
Yeah, and to illustrate as well them being somewhat revitalised, they release another album the year after, which is for them quite prolific, Get Fixed in 2019. I don't know, maybe the other projects they'd been working on were less intrusive at this point. This album actually summoned a band that I've not mentioned yet, but I think are quite relevant to that sound, Pinback. It's like a slightly chunkier version of them. I do think Pinback are a better band overall, but this has nods to them. The bass is a lot higher in the mix in this one as well, so the whole record feels a wee bit heavier. I thought the third track in this one, I Am Goddamn, is probably the most enjoyable standout on the record.
Yeah, Stranded Satellite's pretty good as well.
I think these were written and recorded mostly during the Vitriola sessions, and I think I read somewhere that they had thought about releasing a double album, so thank fuck they didn't do that. I'd rather two alright records than one big bloated shit record. We should do an episode on double albums, because, I mean, are there any good ones?
Melancholy and Infinite Sadness. Game over. I win. they're an interesting band. We'll obviously go into it in a bit more depth for this album you've chosen. I think I want to mention how much their approach, not just their approach, but all the bands we're touching on in conjunction as well, really seem to have influenced certain scenes. And we've done an episode about the Dundee scene in Scotland, right at its kind of peak between 2000-2005, that sort of era up there of really inventive, unusual post-hardcore bands, maybe just a few years behind the curve of their American counterparts, but probably because they were hearing a lot of these groups. And I think Cursive are one of the bands that seem to have left a bit of a mark in that scene. You can hear them in the bands of that era, like Venetian Love Triangle, Mercury Tilt Switch, Katie Bar the Door, and even some of the early Leto stuff. That willingness to experiment, starting with post-hardcore, but then throwing other ingredients in there and making some kind of fusion food from it, that seems to have really taken up there in particular. And I hear, when I was listening through the back catalogue, I could hear a lot of those, and it was quite nostalgic in its own way, even though I don't think many of the Cursive songs really jump out at me. I do overall like the aesthetic. It's not lazy, let's put it that way. It's trying stuff. I don't think it always succeeds, but it's trying stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that I also find quite unnerving about Tim, is that he does that, you know. He's not afraid to explore the muse and go wherever it takes him. If it doesn't fit for this record or this band, he'll do a solo record or he'll do a Good Life album. And I like that, you know. I like a musician that takes chances, and I do find that quite an endearing quality as well. I think that Cursive are more miss than hit, like, over the piece, but... Mm-hmm. I think the record, The Ugly Organ, is by far and away their magnum opus, if you want to put it that way, I suppose.
It's the one that if people are like, oh, I've heard of that one. You know, when you start saying, do you know any cursive records? Oh yeah, I know that one.
Yeah, but it's also the one that, like, I don't think we could have really chosen any other one for being unsung in their discography. I think, well, I mean, Mark we'll talk about
pretty
it.
Pretty close to Happy Hollow, didn't
yeah, it? Maybe. Yeah, maybe. But
no, but I mean, I agree, and I mean, 170,000. It was their biggest album, but it's not exactly explosively huge. For 2003, you know, Linkin Park were selling, was it how many million?
Probably 130 million.
Yeah. So yeah.
This was the first time I'd listened to it. So
well, let's talk about it, Mark. Let's talk about it. Their fourth album got 4 stars on Rolling Stone, 170,000 sales. Concept album about art, music, and how like song and the singer and the music and the audience all impact upon each other in a kind of reflexive way. Mm-hmm. This was the first full album after the addition of cello, which widened the scope of their sound considerably. But can we just as well make clear that, to disambiguate, we are talking about the original release, which is shorter than the re-release.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Although I would like to talk about a couple of songs on the re-release, because the 18th to EU by, which is a sort of splitted by Japanese band, a couple of songs that are pretty good, but we'll come to that at the end. Chris has just done the history, so let's just dive in, I suppose. The Ugly Organist that opens with like this cool wee intro. I guess this is the protagonist of the concept album. I quite enjoy this because it sets the atmosphere and the tone, not just for the whole album, yeah, but it also takes us in a new direction for Cursive. This is like, what the fuck is this? Tim's playing the organ on this record, which is
he ugly?
I don't know, actually.
That's subjective.
That's subjective.
Join us next week once we've spent a wee while leafing through pictures of him.
Which is a thing he hadn't done before on an album, which is pretty cool. And then we go right into Red Handy's Sleight of Hand. Strong opening.
Some Red Handed Sleight of Hand.
Oh, sorry. I always call it Red Handed Sleight of Hand. Some Red Handed Sleight of Hand, yeah. Really strong.
Loads of cello on it.
Yeah, loads of cello. Some of it's overdriven a little bit distorted, which is nice. The production here is like light years ahead of anything that's come before. Mm-hmm. Like right off the bat, you can tell like it's much more confident, it's more assured, everything's cleaner. I don't know if you guys had listened to the original and the reissue, but the reissues kind of rebalance some of the guitars, the cello. The cello pops out a lot more, but the cello and the keys add a really whole brand new layer to Cursive. If this is the first time you've come into Cursive and you try and go back to listen to the other stuff like I did, there is definitely something missing, because there is fundamentally instruments that are not there.
This is quite poppy, and it immediately sounds potentially sellable, knowing what was going on at the time as well. But even just in any circumstance, it's accessible. It follows a lot of the sort of melodic patterns and habits of pop punk. I don't love it, but you know, I can acknowledge how well realised it is as a song, and it kind of marries that very emo vocal to little bits there at the drive and eccentricity. It kind of gets that balance fairly well.
Yeah, his voice is so much better in this song as well than it has been in any other record.
Yeah, this is like, I think Jimmy Eat World did that as well. Like, remember the first couple of Jimmy Eat World records, the vocals were very understated, and then all of a sudden they were just like polished and kind of sparkling and very expressive. And that's what Cursive did here. Mm-hmm. I just want to talk about my first impression of this, because this is the first proper track on the record, and I was quite taken aback by how off my expectations were. For some reason, maybe it's just because of the artwork or because they're on Saddle Creek, I always thought that they were going to be like fucking Modest Mouse or Arcade Fire or something like that. And then this comes in and it's just, it's way more pop punk than I thought it was going to be. And immediately I was like, oh holy shit, it sounds like Thursday with violins. well, cello. And we haven't talked about them at all, but like I think throughout the record they sound an awful lot like Murder by Death.
Think you suffered well, you ain't seen shit, yeah. The pain won't set in for a long, long time.
Whose second album came out in 2003 as well, I think. And like they're a sort of indie rock band with a cello. I'll talk about my overall thoughts about the record, but I was just like so taken aback by how pop punky it was.
You said they segue pretty smoothly into that Art Is Hard, that third track, Mark. It's well chosen in the sense that they kick it off with a very slightly oddly timed riff, and it's to avoid any people like David, for example, arriving at the party and being like, oh, this is what this band do. They're trying to keep their options open, I think, at early stages of this record, and that's probably a pretty savvy idea.
I like that it's a little discordant. They've been playing with it for a while and it's good to hear it in a more polished packaging. When the cello in the mix is pretty huge, and I think the melody in this song is probably one of the strongest, and it was definitely one of the strongest in their career at this point, if not overall. It's quite catchy. The chorus is really, really cool. I like it, and the bridge, the wee bit that they do in between the chorus and the verses is quite snazzy as well.
Funny that Dave mentioned expecting Modest Mouse, because the fourth track in it, The Recluse. Is Modest Mouse. It's
like a pop punk Modest Mouse.
The guitar riff though is just everything about it, the way it's played, the tone, everything. It's so Modest Mouse of that time. That lo-fi indie emo that I was talking about. I mean, Johnny Marr ended up playing with Modest Mouse, didn't he? So
yeah, it's true. I quite like the melody and structure of that song though. The female backing vocal's quite nice. And it keeps dipping in and out of different grooves and textures. I know nothing about Modest Mouse. I've never listened to them. So,
now, if you like a song, you'd love Modest Mouse early on. The Moon in Antarctica, those kind of albums. Yeah, you'd love that.
This is like one of the most listened to songs on Spotify as well.
Probably Modest Mouse fans. Track 5, Herald Frankenstein's just this little
interlude thing.
Segue. Yeah. And then it goes into track 6, Butcher the Song. This actually starts to get pretty interesting for me at this point, because this song sounds like The Paper Chase. And I fucking love The Paper Chase. And what we're seeing is a pattern of this band sounding like other bands. And I think at this stage, I was aware in my notes, I was like, am I just engaging in really lazy journalism here? Does this band sound a lot like these bands? So I think to try and answer that for myself, I was trying to look at the chronology of the bands that were using as reference points. And I think, for example, with The Paper Chase, Hide the Kitchen Knives, the era of Paper Chase that this sounds most like, arguably, was the year before this album was written. And I think there is no way that The Paper Chase didn't impact upon his musical consciousness. Mm-hmm. When you hear this, the kind of ugly, oddball use of the cello in this really adds to the butcher, murder, sinister atmosphere that's hinted to in the title. the very soft, creepy vocals that quickly rise up into these yelps. They're not really sung, they're kind of deliberately yelped. It's very John Congleton, the diminished use of notes in the verses, the heavier guitar sound. It's a really big nod to Paper Chase. And so I was thinking to myself, am I going to be saying, oh, this band sound like just other bands, and that's a redundant observation because they are their own thing. But as I hopefully bring together in my summary here, I don't think there's any way you can get away from the fact that this band sound very often like big chunks of other very, very good bands, and sort of their own identity sometimes gets a little bit subsumed. That's my takeaway at this stage, and I think it's, I don't know how you guys feel about this particular song, but I think it's upheld by the next one as well.
I like this song. I love the ebb and flow of it. I think the loud bits are pretty nasty feeling, like you said. It's quite jagged and the cello is kind of odd. It gives it a kind of darkness. It kind of reminded me of Tom Waits, to be honest, a little bit.
That's something, though, if you've spent much time with the Paper Chase, that they absolutely have. They're like an emo version of Tom Waits in a lot of their stuff, especially that sort of Knife Chase, Mule Variations, Blood Money era Tom Waits.
Yeah, it's also something, I'll reference him again, is Murder by Death has that sort of whiskey soaked saloon bar vibe to it.
It's weirdly noirish in its own way. Yeah. A little bit of horror movie sort of hints. The seventh one, Driftwood, A Fairy Tale, I think the vocals are pretty strong in that one. What I do think is that it starts to become obvious that for me, for my personal tastes, this album picks up halfway quite significantly. I think the second half of it is considerably better than the first half.
Which is funnily enough, the Pitchfork review said the exact opposite. Going on brand there by disagreeing precisely with Pitchfork, Chris.
But I didn't even know that, so I'm glad that my natural instincts are accurate. But the eighth one, A Gentleman Caller, again, back into Paper Chase territory, very angular. Cello work, yeah. Cello works really well in it. Mm-hmm. Nicely layered up.
It's feedback for me, the verses, man. I love that shit. Like
I was going to say, loads of energy, a bit of frenzy in this song. It's the most interesting song I think that so far, and it's not exactly catchy, but I do really like their musical approach on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the tortured horns and the cello. The way the cello echoes the main riff when it gets heavy is a really cool twist, man, and I have no reference for those other bands that you've mentioned. I've not listened to them.
Have you not spent time with Paper Chase?
Not that much. I've heard some stuff, but not the stuff I would kind of recognise alongside this.
So, Hide the Kitchen Knives is an album that I have already decided I'm bringing to this for a future episode, so I'll speed that up a wee bit because it's phenomenal. It's this, but much, much darker. Mm-hmm. And I would say with very slightly stronger hooks, but you know, we'll get there.
So the next track is Harold Weathervane.
Really theatrical delivery on it. I like the use of the bell on this one.
Yeah, it's really cool, isn't it?
That's great. It's a really good ingredient. I don't know who had that moment inspiration in the studio, but buy them a pint.
Apparently, just to give a bit of context on the sort of oral history of this record, Tim Casher comes in with full songs, the bones of songs. But apparently, Ted Stevens was really the one who was responsible for sort of bringing this whole thing together as a cohesive kind of thing.
The album concepts, he ties them in, doesn't he?
Yeah, so that was probably his idea. It's probably his idea.
It's also, I'm pretty sure it's got a street sample, like a sort of field recording street sample in the background of it of someone walking. Either that or I was just losing my mind.
It probably does, actually, because they're trying to go for a kind of creepy vibe. I like the way everything sits in the mix in this song. The cello, it echoes the guitar again. It's really loud in the mix, and because of that, the guitars can kind of go off and do kind of cool and interesting things. It kind of feels like it's half a song because it's got that outro. of just the organist doing unsettling organy things.
yeah, the structure's interesting. The DI'd, I think it's DI'd guitar, it's certainly very dry. That wee motif, the atonal motif, is pretty cool. And I think they do get a nice blend of theatre and punk rock in this one, and it's probably the most successful experiment on the album. Track 10, Bloody Murder.
Yeah, Bloody Murderer.
Murderer?
Is it Murderer? That's a murderer.
Is it murderer?
I've written murderer. Maybe
it's bloody murderer. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that. Yeah.
There we go. Let's say that again in Scottish. Bloody murderer.
Bloody murderer. Murder.
I love how it just sounds. This song just sounds like clattering to me. It's like they're all in separate rooms, playing slightly every time, different tones.
It's anti-rock. Like, yeah, that's the thing. It's anti-rock, man. It starts with like a trademark sort of anti-rock US maple type deconstructionalist thing. It's just, deliberately awkward. More bells in it as well.
Got Jenny Lewis from Rilo Kiley on it. I think she appears on a few tracks. It sounds like everybody in the studio is just going, let's fuck about. Yeah.
It's an interesting arrangement. That's maybe a euphemism, but it's nasty, but I think it avoids sounding derivative. And again, I don't think the tune, the melody, the memorability factor for me is not high in terms of singing it to yourself, but it's a really cool set of ideas, and it's ambitious, and I like that part of it, so it's a bit more cerebral than anything else. Sierra, 11th track.
Yeah, more kind of straight ahead, kind of back to a more kind of standard vibe, I think. I like the driving nature of it.
Yeah, it's got a kind of ambitious emo with a twist feel to it. And the best song in the album.
The best song in the album, yeah. It's
alive.
Almost like a post-rock song.
What a fucking great song.
So like,
huge. How many minutes long is it? Ten and a half minutes long?
10 minutes,
it's fucking big, experimental, proggy ending. It's got loads of interesting dynamics on it. There's a terrific, big, tuneful moment about 2 minutes 55 that is just really fucking well done. It's by far the best moment of melody in the whole record. And the way the song finishes as well is so delicate and, as you say, quite post-rocky. It's actually quite annoying that they can do that so well and that they don't choose to do it more often. I think it's a really, really good song. Mm-hmm. And probably, if I'm perfectly honest, the only one I would go back and listen to recreationally.
It is an annoying way to end the record because it's like you could have done that before and more of that. But, you know, I like this record's ambition. I like that it's weird. I like that it's sold so many fucking copies, despite the fact that it is a deeply strange record for the time and for the people that they're associated with.
Yeah, they were surfing a wave, though. I mean, there was a lot of bands selling big, big amounts.
They thought that Saddle Creek were not going to put it out for them because they thought it was too strange. You know, they had a lot of reservations about the release of the record, and they didn't think it would do particularly well. So when it sold as much as it did, they were all like, what the fuck is going on here? How did this happen? And I think that's a pretty cool story as well.
So my rundown on them, I think they're actually quite a cool, certainly a really ambitious group. I think they, as I said about Dundee, I think they impacted upon a lot of people's consciousness and a lot of scenes. And I think my core realisation is that at their best, they have a really, really interesting sound that is distinctly cursive. But I think over the balance, and also specifically at a number of points in this album, they too often sound like a jumble of bits of other really, really good bands. And just, as I said, trying to weigh up if that was just me being lazy as a journalist, I think chronologically that's sort of evidenced by the fact that a lot of these bands had made really standout records in the year or 2 years prior to their flavour suddenly appearing in cursive. Now, I'm not saying cursive were going about ripping people off, but I think those elements were just sticking, but then not being infused into the songwriting as much. They were sort of still too lumpy, you know. They needed to get them in there, and they needed to blend them, and they needed to blend it, not just have big chunks of At the Drive-In Carrot and big chunks of Liz Savvy Fav Potato hanging about. It's just like it needed to be better mixed, I think.
I can't wait to try a soup.
Yeah, I made sure it was vegan, just even in my analogy for you, David.
I think, no, I can't complete a soup analogy, can I?
The melting pot versus the mixing bowl, isn't it? It's the old racial analogy.
Well, yeah, exactly.
I would rather that it be a melting pot, but it's a bit of a mixing bowl. A lot of croutons.
I find this record hard to love, even though it has a lot of ingredients that I totally appreciate. But to me, it kind of has a quite sort of indie darling vibe to it. And I think it's maybe a better product than it is a album to listen to. Mm-hmm. I think it's, if you come from a hardcore background, I think it's more expansive and indie than you're used to. But if you come from an indie background, it's like maybe just provides a little bit of aggressiveness and wonk that you might be taken aback by and enjoy. But I think in terms of the production, the artwork, the name, the sound, it works really well, but I don't think it has enough good songs on it. I can see why it's very influential, because I think you go, oh, I really liked what Cursive did. Going deep on it, you're like, oh, there's not actually as many parts in it that I enjoy, but I feel like it. Do you kind of get what I mean? It leaves more of an impression than it actually deserves, maybe?
Yeah, it's like I was saying in the structure, when I'm listening to them, I'm like, oh, they've done a really good job of that. But at no point have I been able to sit and hum one of their songs. It's not left any real mark on my psyche in that sense. They occupy a space, and it's very well realised, but yeah. it doesn't sort of jump out musically. I would just say it as well, in terms of my verdict, I think in the big scheme of our discography of unsung albums, there's going to be a lot of bands that we've mentioned in this discussion in there. I don't think it needs to be absolutely overloaded with every alternative emo and post-hardcore band that came about. And whilst I think Cursive did some really impressive stuff, and I'm sure loads of people will be raging because this album is a bit of an indie darling album, it doesn't make that cut for me. So that's where I stand in it. Whilst I would say, if you're into it, definitely listen to it.
Boo. I would say go and listen to Who Will Survive and What Will Be Left of Them by Murder by Death, which came out the same year and didn't have the marketing that this record did, and wasn't as cool as this record, but maybe has better songs on it.
Boo.
I understand, Mark, but I'm sorry.
Boo.
All right, Mark. I mean, you give it your best shot.
Well, you know.
Hey, it may well get voted in.
It may. I think our listeners probably will vote this in if like emo.
Emo guys are loyal, just not to the girlfriend.
If you like this record,
hey,
17 years ago, then you'll probably vote it in. But
I'll have you know that I turned in a job with gangsters lately. My morals are fine.
Yeah, you did, but you're not an emo anymore.
I'm not.
You're a man of the world.
I'm just a man of the world.
So, it's Nexus time. There's something pretty special in the tank.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the first time we're seeing Nexus tonight. Will it be the last? What do they have in store
this
for us?
This is not good for...
Why am I here? You're in the Nexus. This is the Nexus. For you, this is what you want.
Well, Mark, you go first, seeing as it's your record. Who... I believe it was
I wrote down how to say it.
Yeah, Kenny Bonella wrote this, and it is Jamaluddin Abdujaparov. Is that correct, Chris?
Jamaluddin Abdujaparov. So Jamaluddin Abdujaparov,
aka the Tashkent Terror.
Yep.
Cyclist.
Uzbekistan.
Cyclist who, yeah. Mark, I won't spoil your ending. I know where you're going with it, so go for it.
Really? Okay. So this album was produced by Mike Mogis. He used to play for Cursive as well, way back in the early days. He also plays for She and Him, which is a sort of kind of country indie duo featuring M-Word and Zooey Deschanel. Zooey Deschanel is an actress and is perhaps most well known for her time in New Girl. She's also been in a whole bunch of films.
She's just a set of bangs.
Just a set of bangs, yeah. In season 6, episode 4 of New Girl, they actually have a very brief crossover with Brooklyn Nine-Nine, in which Jess finds herself in a weird situation while she's driving in New York and ends up bumping into Jake Peralta, who's played by Andy Samberg. Andy Samberg is a really good actor. He's actually in a film just now called Palm Springs, which I recommend if you haven't seen it. It's a good film. It's kind of like Groundhog's Day. It's pretty cool. He actually
just pluralise it. What? Groundhog's Day.
Groundhog's Day.
Groundhog's Day. Yeah, because there's more than one day. But he and
Attorneys General.
There's more than one Attorney General. To be fair, is that a party of attorneys? Attorney Generals are called. He recently appeared. Well, a few years ago, he appeared in a Netflix special called Tour de Pharmacy, which is a mockumentary about doping at the Tour de France in 1982. This didn't actually happen, but a short synopsis of the film is that Samberg plays a Nigerian rider who is one of only four riders in the Tour de France that year because everyone else who was caught doping was also caught paying off the president of the International Cycling Union, and we're all thus banned from the tournament. It has John Cena playing an Austrian in it, and he's amazing. Highly recommend it. It's on Netflix, only about 40 minutes long. Lance Armstrong actually appears in the documentary as an outside observer about the incident, and he wishes to remain not anonymous for the whole film, but obviously the joke is they fuck up making him anonymous, so you know quite clearly that it's Lance Armstrong talking about doping, which didn't go down very well with some critics. As people probably know, Lance Armstrong won the Tour de France 7 times, but he was stripped of all of his titles due to doping. He won his first title in 1999. And that was 1 year after the Festina affair, which was another doping scandal that involved a bunch of riders from two teams in 1998. Now, I don't know if you guys know, but the Tour de France has a very big history of doping. It's like 60-odd years worth of it. But this particular scandal happened when judges found banned substances on the Festina team, including growth hormones and testosterone. The trial focused on amphetamines that was used by some of the team, and EPO, which is basically it's an enzyme that's created by your kidneys when you're in response to what's called cellular hypoxia, which is when red blood cells are produced by the kidneys in response to inadequate blood supply. They create more so your blood supply can go faster. And they actually were looking for a usage of the human made EPO, which is called rh EPO. After the Festina team were tested, they then tested the TVM team. But the most interesting thing about this is that this trial actually also brought into effect testing for blood doping transfusions, which is one of the things that got Lance Armstrong stripped of his titles. Somebody who was later retrospectively involved in the Festina affair was Laurent Jalabert. Mm-hmm. He wasn't immediately implicated in it, but they did after the trial in 2004, they did a retrospective test of 60 rider samples, and he was found to have taken EPO as well. Jalabert is one of only five riders to win points classifications in all three Grand Tours, the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia and the Volta a España. The others are Alessandro Preci, Eddy Merckx, Mark Cavendish and of course your Uzbekistan.
Yeah, you've got to say his name.
I don't know how to say his name.
Jamaluddin Abdujarparov.
That guy.
Right, can we just pause a moment to reflect on how fucking shite cycling is?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, cycling is fine if you need to get around, okay? But see, if you sit and watch cycling, fucking kill yourself.
I mean, it's literally superhuman what they do, because it's physically not possible because they're all on huge amounts of drugs.
On drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also, but it's also superhuman and boring.
Yeah, but you get nice views of the Alps.
And their arse. Yeah. In Lycra. That's what you meant.
Yeah.
Right, you go next for that, because mine's a beast.
All right, I've managed to do a quick one, actually. Cursive, in 2004, toured with The Cure. The Cure, in 1993, played in Finsbury Park with Belly and Sugar and Catherine Wheel. It was a festival thing called Great Expectations. And, yeah, The Cure headlined, and Carter, the Unstoppable Sex Machine, were second headliners.
Oh yeah, Carter USM.
So yeah, Carter USM. One member of Carter USM is Les Carter, who lives in Folkestone, and he also plays in a band called Abdujarparov, and they are named after Jamaluddin Abdujarparov.
That guy.
That guy. The guy from Uzbekistan.
That is a very tidy, well-formed nexus you've got there, man. Yes. I like it. Mine is not like that. Okay, let's get torn through this, okay? Cursive merged with a band called Symbols Eat Guitars to make a band called Cursive Eat Guitars to cover a track called Hey Jealousy by a band called The Gin Blossoms for the AV Club's Undercover series, which featured, I think, 25 different cover versions and included also Ben Folds covering Elliott Smith's Say Yes. Ben Folds both co-wrote and produced the album Has Been by Mr. William Shatner that was released in 2004, featuring a whole host of great people on it, but we're not going to go down that route. William Shatner was Captain Kirk, as we all know, in the series Star Trek, written by Gene Roddenberry. When discussing and, I guess, defending Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry used the Drake equation to try and justify the sheer number of alien civilizations. However, Gene Roddenberry also misquoted the Drake equation and kind of he didn't have it to hand, so the version he ended up using was just totally fannied together by him. The Drake equation was written by Frank Drake in 1961, and it's basically about the number of alien civilizations that are likely to exist in our galaxy.
I love that fact, by the way.
It's not actually intended to calculate the number of alien civilizations, though. It was more devised to stimulate discussion at the very first ever SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, meeting. The lowest estimates, according to the Drake equation, which kind of use the more sceptical values, including things like the rare earth hypothesis, come out at 10 to the negative 13 power-wise. So we're very, very probably alone. But the highest estimates, the figure that tends to get bandied about is that 15,600,000 intelligent species in the Milky Way galaxy, although that has a variance of a factor of 100, so 100 more or 100 times less, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So it's quite a big boundary on that. The Drake equation then led to the Kardashev scale in 1964, which is by a guy called Nikolai Kardashev. And that's to do with the number of hypothetical civilizations that qualify as 1, 2, or 3. 1 being a civilization that can utilize the energy of its planet, 2 being the energy of the solar system, and 3 being a civilization that can utilize the energy of its galaxy and therefore has unbelievable amounts of energy at its disposal and is therefore probably capable of doing magnificent, enormous, unimaginably huge things. And so that's all to try and gauge the sort of intelligence, sophistication and power mastery of these civilizations. Anyway, so the Kardashev scale leads to the Fermi paradox. The Fermi paradox was devised by Enrico Fermi, and it's really there to discuss, is alien life likely if we haven't encountered it, which is kind of has a lot in common with the kind of time traveler paradox, is if time travel is possible, why have we never met a time traveler? Now, the Fermi paradox leads on to the Great Filter Theory. The Great Filter Theory has become relevant recently. The Great Filter Theory basically says that the easier it is for life to propagate and potentially evolve, the worse it actually bodes for humanity. Because if life is easy and yet hasn't evolved to a certain stage and contacted us, then there's probably something called the Great Filter, which could be in our past or could be in our future, which restricts that evolution. Now, the recent discovery of PH3 or phosphine gas on Venus suggested that there could be life on Venus in the atmosphere. That is a big problem in the sense of the Great Filter Theory, because we're looking at the prospect of there possibly being life on Mars, or at least the history of life on Mars, history of possible life on Venus. If life is that easy and yet we have never encountered life, then the Great Filter Theory starts to look pretty daunting, because it says maybe there's a very, very, very high chance that like evolved civilization overextends itself in every different situation.
Well, I mean, look out the window. I mean, that seems very reasonable.
Super well illustrated, yeah, by people's refusal to wear masks or even acknowledge global warming properly. Venus is the place that they discovered phosphine gas. The surface of Venus is 408 degrees centigrade. So vaporized minerals, for example, condense at the top of some of the colder mountains, and actually you get metal snow and frost as a result. And more relevant to us, craters on Venus are named after the wives of a character from a famous Russian, inverted commas, Western, sort of like Russian cowboy film almost, called White Son of the Desert. And the wives were married to a character called Abdullah, who's the main villain in that film. And because of his appearance, Abdullah was actually the derogatory nickname people used to use for Jamaluddin Abdujaparov.
Well, there you are.
There we are, pulling out of the bag
literally to the edge of the galaxy and back.
Well, thanks for that. I just want to mention, because you kind of went there, I would recommend, it's on Netflix right now, I think it's only like 15-20 minutes long, but a wee documentary called John Was Trying to Contact Aliens. And it's very gentle, sort of follows a guy who basically set up a radio station in his grandma's house, broadcasting to outer space, because he just wanted to try and see if there was anybody out there, and if so, he wanted to play them some good music. Yeah, I'd recommend to all listeners that you should go and watch that on Netflix, because it's just bloody lovely.
Yeah, it looks good.
Oh, well, thanks for that.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Bit of skilling.
Well, we went round all the houses there.
We did.
So go to Facebook and vote whether Cursive Ugly Organ should be on it or not.
Just to say that we're having trouble with the polls on Facebook just now. So that is the actual
polling
mechanism, the actual polling mechanism, not the country.
Steady on.
So please click through to our website and vote on there, because there's so few people voting because it's not on Facebook. So you have to actually go on the website. Might take a wee second to load the poll, but please go and do that. Thank you.
So next week, what are we doing?
Next week, we are going to do The Eraser by Tom York.
Wow. Ooh,
okay, interesting.
And
do a Nexus.
That noise means we're going to remember to choose our Nexus live on air this time. Or, well, live on recording. So we will be Nexusing Tom York to Lee Atwater.
Great, no idea who that is.
you're going to have a fun time looking at that one. Chosen by Corey Stewart. Thanks, Corey.
Thanks, Corey.
I, for one, love delving into American politics. So, Lee Atwater to Tom York next week. Don't miss it. Thrilling.
All right. Well, that was a pleasure.
Please get yourselves onto the polls, and please get yourself onto our Patreon as well if you haven't subscribed, because you'll get the episodes earlier and you'll get bonus stuff. And we have some cool new ideas that we're probably going to announce at least one or two of them next week. And you won't know that unless you're part of the inner clique.
Great.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.